For those of you who've been attending the class, you know that for the last couple of weeks, I've been sharing with you a presentation that I was asked to do in Tulsa a few weeks ago at a Christian ministry called City Elders. And I was asked to teach about the Christian influence in the Constitution. Now, I generally spend a lot more time emphasizing the Declaration of Independence, as all of you know that attend my class have heard me say over and over. Well, right after we do the second part of my presentation, or my second presentation in Tulsa, I was actually up there for 2 weeks in a row, we're going to actually spend a few weeks looking at the Declaration of Independence, which I believe is the far more critical document of our founding documents. But I was asked to do the Christian influence, or what you might call the Christian roots of the Constitution, and I agreed to do so, and it went over so well, I thought that the folks here in our class might enjoy it. And so, if you remember a couple of weeks ago, I taught the first part of part one, and then the second part of part one last week. Well, today we're going to begin part two, which was my second presentation in Tulsa the following week. And so this is actually part two of our discussion on the Constitution, even though it's actually the third lesson here in our pastor's class. So you'll have an outline that ought to have all of the issues that we'll be discussing today. And based upon the time, what I would like to do is get all the way through the preamble to the Constitution. So what we're going to do now is, we've talked a lot the last 2 weeks about the Christian influence in the Constitution, and what we want to do today is we want to talk about the Constitution itself. Now, let's do just a real quick review. Number one, remember we discussed how self-governance is historically extremely rare and fragile. There are very few cultures in history that have had the privilege of governing themselves. Most people have lived under some type of monarchy or dictatorship, and most of those were tyrannous. People lived under tyranny for most of mankind's history. America is one of those rare exceptions. And by the way, that's where the term American exceptionalism comes from. It's not that we think we're better than anyone else. That's not it at all. We believe that the form of government that we have is superior to the forms of government that most people in history have lived under. So that's why we believe that America is an exceptional country. It doesn't mean we're better, because the truth is we've committed many atrocities and sins in our own history that we're still working to try to correct. So we're not better people at all. We're not smarter. We're not more godly. But we are one of the privileged few cultures that have had the opportunity to live in self-governance. Now, we have two founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. As I've already said, the Declaration, in my opinion, is far more important than the Constitution. Oddly enough, few people talk about the Declaration today. They're always talking about the Constitution. But there are those who attack the Constitution and claim that it's godless, that the framers intended for our Constitution to not reflect godly principles. They'll make the argument God is not found in the Constitution. Well, he isn't. That is true. But he's found all over the Declaration of Independence. And those who wrote the Constitution, whether you agree or not that the Articles of Confederation should have been trashed and the Constitution that we know today should have replaced the Articles, the one thing you can admit is that those who wrote the Constitution had participated in the writing and the embrace approval of the Declaration of Independence. Had many of them participated in the War of Independence, and so they understood the godly principles behind self-governance, and so they didn't think they had to restate those. So the Constitution was built upon the Declaration. So you've got John Adams in letters in 1798 and 1813 saying the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. They understood that without morality, which is a byproduct of Christianity, then people cannot self-govern not only themselves in government, but they can't even self-govern themselves. And so if you can't govern yourself, how in the world could you have a form of self-governance for the entire country? This is what Benjamin Franklin, of course, was trying to say when he said in 1787, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. And we spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks talking about that. So you have the Declaration of Independence, of course, approved, and the signing began on July the 4th, 1776. The Declaration then was part and parcel to the Articles of Confederation, which had pulled the colonies together into 13 sovereign, we call them states, they were colonies then, sovereign colonies that came together as a union. The Articles of Confederation had many strengths, some weaknesses, but in the end, the Articles are replaced with the Constitution that we know today. The Constitutional Convention convenes on May the 25th, 1787. By September the 17th, 1787, they have the new Constitution. They all vote for it, at least 39 of the 55 delegates that were there voted for it. Some left in protest, as we talked last time. There were a number who walked away. But that Constitution was based upon certain principles found in the Declaration, like all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So the idea is the governed are actually the government in a republic, especially in our republic, and those who serve in government, i.e. Congress, are there as our employees to do our bidding. That's the way the framers saw it. Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, is on both sides of the fence sometimes, but he did say some things that were certainly worth noting. And one of the things that he said that is found in his papers as a fragment, it's called A Fragment on the Constitution and the Union, never appeared in a speech as far as we know, but it's in his papers. He called the Declaration the apple of gold and the Constitution the silver frame around it. And he said that the apple was not made for the frame, but the other way around, the frame was made for the apple. So when you get a picture, you don't get a picture so you can have a frame. You have a frame to go around a picture. And so Lincoln understood that the Declaration was the most important document. So ultimately then the Constitution is a way to codify the principles found in the Declaration into law. And that's what the Constitution is. So the convention had met all summer long. 70 delegates had been appointed, 55 attend. Only 39 actually signed the Constitution. 10 of the 16 who didn't sign it actually refused to sign because they believed that it gave the government too much power, meaning the central government. They believed in strong state governments. They believed that's where the liberties were best protected. And so they wanted the states to be sovereign and strong. But the central government guys wanted a strong central government. So that's where we pick up today then with the actual components of the Constitution. Now, to give you an idea of how the framers understood the plight of man, I want to give you a quote from John Adams in his A Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States of America. They understood, they meaning the framers, not all were Christians, certainly, but most of them were heavily influenced by Christian thinking, by the Bible. They had a profound respect for the Bible and the God of the Bible. And so they understood that man was fallen, and in his fallen state, tends to want to abuse his fellow man, and if he can accumulate power, then he will use that power to dominate his neighbors. So I want you to listen to what John Adams said. He said, "To expect self-denial from men when they have a majority in their favor and consequently power to gratify themselves is to disbelieve all history and universal experience. It is to disbelieve revelation and the word of God, which informs us the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." There John Adams is, of course, quoting from the book of Jeremiah. Such exalted virtue never yet existed in any large body of men and lasted long. There is no man so blind as not to see that to talk of founding a government upon a supposition that nations and great bodies of men left to themselves will practice a course of self-denial is either to babble like a newborn infant or to deceive like an unprincipled imposter. Now that's a rather long quote, but let me boil it down to its simplest terms. Adams is saying because of the fallenness of man, you cannot trust even good men to use power properly. Most people ultimately are corrupted by power. So power corrupts absolutely, and absolute power completely corrupts. And that's just an old saying that we have followed for years. And Adams knew that, and so did many of the other framers. And so they understood that the fallen nature of man just makes government that much more difficult. So this is why they believe these documents were so important. So when you come to their writing the Constitution, whether you agree or not that they should have been replacing the Articles of Confederation, the truth is they did. So we have the Constitution. So we have to deal with what's in it. And sadly, most Christians do not understand that the Constitution was actually written to limit the government. Now, let me first back up and tell you that initially it was not that way. Most people are surprised to learn that when the Constitution was first written and put out for ratification, there was a large segment of America that rejected it. And here's the reason. They said, well, the Constitution tells us what the government can do, but what it doesn't do is tell us what the government can't do. So they said the Constitution lists the positive powers of government, what it can do, but it doesn't list the negative powers, what it cannot do. And see, the framing generation had come out of what they believed was tyranny under King George and the Parliament. So they were far more concerned about what government can do to you than what government can do for you. Now, think of today. That has completely flipped, and today most people are far more interested in what government's going to do for them. What's government going to do for me here? What's government going to do for me? Everyone's looking for a handout. Well, while we're worried about what government can do for us, look at what government is doing to us. It's a real problem. So they were very, very concerned. Well, because of this, you're going to see the first 10 amendments to the Constitution and what we call the Bill of Rights. And we'll get to those later in our discussion next week. But it was a real concern. So here are the framers. They know that government tends to go corrupt eventually, if not immediately. So they need to put these chains on government to chain it down. But then the Constitution itself didn't do that initially. Now, in defense of many of the framers, they thought it did. They thought that they had created enough checks and balances, and they had enumerated the powers of the federal government enough that it listed what the federal government could do. Then that's in Article 1, Section 8. And then in Section 9, it says some of the things that Congress can't do. So I think if you were to have asked them, they would say, well, we thought we chained it down enough. But they didn't. And, of course, we're living evidence that they didn't. But they tried to fix that by amending it immediately right out of the gate. And we'll get to that in a second. So if we understand the Constitution, I think we're miles ahead of most people. Now, I know that for a lot of folks, they say, well, I don't know that this is a proper lesson to be taught in church. Well, I would ask, where are we going to teach it? I mean, where are we going to talk about the Christian influence of the Constitution? Or where are we just going to talk about the original intent of the Constitution? I mean, where are we going to do that? I believe church is the best place for this because we bring a Christian perspective to it. So it's very important that believers understand in a republic what their Constitution says. Because, friends, I'm telling you, in a republic, you remember Benjamin Franklin said, you've got a republic if you can keep it. Republics are fragile, very fragile. And if the citizens do not engage in a republic, then the republic will devolve into something else. And it will always move towards centralized power away from the people into tyranny. Now, that's just the way it is. And because citizens over the last 100 and 150 years at least have not known what our form of government is and how it functions, we've disengaged. And the church especially. This whole concept of separation of church and state. We're not going to talk about these things. Well, I'll agree the Bible is our standard for truth. But we live in a republic. And this republic, because of freedom of religion, has allowed the gospel to be freely preached and freely taught and churches to function, exempt from taxation, because the power to tax is the power to control and to destroy. The framers understood all of that. But friends, if we lose this republic, the church will ultimately be driven underground. The gospel will go underground. And we, like all other peoples in history, we meaning Christians, or for that matter, liberty lovers, are going to be persecuted. Now, is that what we want? I mean, is that what we want for ourselves? But even more for me, is that what I want for my adult children and my little grandchildren? I want them to live in some socialist tyranny, which, of course, socialist is just communist. Is that what I want? Of course not. Christians certainly shouldn't want that. So having been set free by the blood of Jesus and been liberated spiritually, Christians ought to have the greatest level of love and respect for external liberty. We ought to be the best citizens in the country. Some of our framers and founders actually said that, but don't want to get too far off into that. So this discussion is very appropriate. So then, what kind of government does our Constitution create? Well, we operate under something called federalism. And most people couldn't define federalism if you asked them to, and most couldn't even tell you that we have a federalist form of government. Now, a little sidebar here that I think is important. In history, if you studied much about history or in civics, you'll read about the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And when you read about them, it becomes very confusing. And it actually seems to be backwards, because it is. Here's what happened. At the Constitutional Convention, there was a group who wanted a strong central government for many reasons. I don't think all of them were nefarious. I disagree with that viewpoint. I believe many of them wanted a strong central government because the states were showing themselves to be very rebellious and not willing to play together. And to be honest with you, they were afraid the Union was going to come apart. And as I've said before, Great Britain would just come over here and pick off the states one at a time. And by the way, the War of 1812 proves that that was a real fear. So you have the people who wanted a strong central government. Well, they would have actually been anti-federal because they were for weak state government. In fact, there were some that didn't want any state governments at all. But they wanted to win the war of words, and so they called themselves Federalists, which was really the opposite of what they were. Well, then there was another group at the convention who believed in strong state governments and state sovereignty and wanted a weak central government. Well, they were the true Federalists, but because the big central government people had already taken the name Federalist, the strong state government people had to call themselves Anti-Federalists, which is the opposite of what they were. So that's why this becomes very confusing. And when you read through history and you try to figure this out, just remember opposite is actually the truth. The Federalists were really Anti-Federalists, and the Anti-Federalists were really Federalists. So what is then federalism? Well, let's give a definition to it. Federalism is a system of government in which two levels of government govern the same area or people. The national or what we call federal government is generally responsible for larger territorial and foreign issues, while the state governments govern the issues of local concern. Additionally, the individual states also retain their autonomy from one another so that the cultural distinctives of one state are unmolested by the cultural distinctives of the other states. So what you have in federalism is you have two governments, federal and state governments, governing the same area and people. And so what you have to do is you have to designate, well, what areas of jurisdiction does the federal government have, and what areas of jurisdiction does the state oversee? That's what federalism is. So we have a federalist form of government. This is why we have states and state governments, and we have the federal government. The state governments have their capitals and their legislatures and their governors and their court systems and their agencies. And then the federal government, seated in Washington, D.C., has all the same things. Initially, the framers made it very clear that the federal government was going to be basically over all the foreign things, tariffs, war, those kind of disputes between the states, all of that. But then the states were going to be responsible for what happened to the people in their everyday lives in that state, i.e. Oklahoma. James Madison makes that very, very clear in Federalist Paper number 45. He says the federal government has very definite and defined and few powers. The states have indefinite powers, and they're just, there are many. Well, we've allowed that to flip, and it's the exact opposite today, which is a big part of our problem, and we may talk about that in future discussions. So in a federalistic system, the cultural, philosophical, religious beliefs of the citizens of the states are protected from a one-size-fits-all overreaching federal government. In this type of government, both the federal government and the state governments have the power to make laws, and both retain a certain level of autonomy. So let's bring this into some kind of layman terminology. Let's compare Oklahoma to Massachusetts. Now, I'm talking about today. There was a time when Massachusetts would have been very conservative and very Christian-oriented. Of course, today it's the exact opposite of that. Oklahoma is still very conservative, and I think you could argue at least Christian-minded. I don't believe that we're filled with Christians in Oklahoma, but we're Christian-minded. We're Christian-friendly. Well, how in the world are you going to have a system where the federal government makes a law about marriage that will satisfy the liberal philosophy of Massachusetts with the very conservative philosophy of Oklahoma? Well, you don't. You allow those states to make their own laws on marriage, to make their own laws on health care, to make their own laws on the issues that affect the everyday lives of their citizens. So Massachusetts can make its laws to reflect its citizens. Oklahoma can make its laws to reflect the views of its citizens. And yet the two states may be very, very divergent. Well, under a federalist system, that's okay as long as the federal government doesn't try to step in and tell both states what they're going to do with, let's say, marriage. If the federal government stays within its lane and just takes care of foreign issues, tariffs, that kind of stuff, we're in good shape. They leave Massachusetts alone to rule its people and leave Oklahoma alone to rule its people. Unfortunately, today what we have is the federal government overreaching and saying, oh, no, 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 no. We decide everything. So we're going to make a one-size-fits-all. So when we make a decree through our Supreme Court that marriage is anything we want it to be, Massachusetts has to live by that. Of course, Massachusetts today says, yay! But they say, Oklahoma, you've got to live by that as well. And we go, boo. Because you see, we still believe in a biblical definition of marriage. One man, one woman. Generally in Massachusetts, it's anything goes. Well, you see now how that won't work. So all of a sudden, you have a big portion of the country being forced to operate against their wills. So you take the issue of abortion, the murder of the preborn. In Oklahoma, we would say no, thumbs down to that. We'd end it. When I was running for governor, if I'd have been elected governor, I was going to push us as hard as I knew how as a state to defy Roe v. Wade and end the murder of the preborn, at least in Oklahoma. Now, I wouldn't force it on Massachusetts. I wouldn't even have the authority to force it on Massachusetts. We could do it in Oklahoma. But see, the federal government has stepped in and said, no. The Constitution gives us that power. Well, it doesn't, but they conferred it upon themselves. So we're going to, in 1973, Roe v. Wade, we're going to say that murdering a preborn child is not a child. It's just tissue. It's the mother's body. And in her own privacy, she can do whatever she wants to do. Oklahoma, you've got to accept that. Now, what they're doing in the end is they're driving a wedge into our culture, forcing us to operate against our wills, which is just simply an untenable situation. Well, that's not what federalism is supposed to be. We have a federalist form of government where the states are supposed to be deciding those issues and the federal government the foreign territorial things. See, as long as you do that, then everything's fine. Well, that is how the Constitution is written. It assumes that that's going to happen. Now, there are many who say, no. Those people were nefarious, and they wrote into it ways to get around it. Well, maybe that's true. But whether they intended to or not, those ways are there, and those loopholes are being exploited by the left in ways that is dizzying today. And if something doesn't happen pretty soon, we're going to lose our republic. It's either going to split, and we're going to fight, or we're going to have a peaceful split, or we're going to be ruled by tyranny from Washington. But something is going to break here really, really soon. So hopefully now you kind of understand what federalism is supposed to be. Now that's the concept that the Constitution would work under, this federalist system. All right, now then, let's go to the actual Constitution itself. Well, like any document, you have an introduction. In a book, you have an introduction. With the Constitution, you have a preamble. Now, when we look at the Declaration in a few weeks, there's also kind of an opening salvo in it. And then when you look at the Bill of Rights, there's a preamble to the Bill of Rights, and we'll look at those. But let's first this morning look at the preamble to the U.S. Constitution. Now, let me just read it to you, and then we'll begin to pick it apart. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense. Defense is spelled with a C because that was the British spelling. Promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now that's the preamble. Now let's pick it apart here very quickly. First of all, notice the opening three words, we the people. This is why Lincoln said in his Gettysburg Address that government of, by, and for the people will not perish from the earth. And by the way, when he did his Gettysburg Address, as we'll point out in a few weeks, he said 67 years ago. Well, he said that on November the 17th, 1863. If you count back 87 years from that date, you won't get to the ratification of the Constitution. No, you'll get to 1776. You see, Lincoln believed the birth of our country was the Declaration of Independence. The birth certificate. Just kind of a little side note. We'll get to it later. But that's the concept. We the people. So the Constitution is a document of the people, by the people, for the people. That's what this is supposed to be. Now, where does that come from? Well, it's not in thin air. And see, most people read the Constitution and they don't remember it's based upon the Declaration. The Declaration of Independence, if you will, is the foundation, and then you put the Constitution on top of it. But most people just talk about the Constitution and they give no regard to the Declaration. So we have no idea where these principles come from. What about we the people? Well, if you go back to the Declaration, it says that government derives its power from where? From God? No. No, the people get their rights from God. Where does government get its power? From the people. So according to the Declaration, you have God the Creator, the creation, the people. God gives the rights to the people, and then the people create government. And the job of government is to protect these people's rights. Today, we have many who believe that God gives the power to the government, and the government doles out liberties to the people as it sees fit. So now you have people today who will talk about the government letting them do certain things. Well, I'm glad the government lets me own a firearm. The government doesn't let you own a firearm. God gave you that inalienable right to protect yourself. So it's very important then that we get the idea. It's we the people, not the government of the United States, the people of the United States. Okay, the next phrase, of the United States. Notice they didn't consider this just to be America. They didn't just say North America. Well, what are we? Are we a monolithic country? No. We're United States. Individual, independent, sovereign states. And we're united. That's very, very important. Our government is found first and foremost with the people. They transfer or delegate some of that authority to their state government, and then they delegate limited power to the federal government. But it's the people, but it's the United States. Everything's done through the states. Then, in order to form a more perfect nation. No, it doesn't say nation, does it? It says union. So there's the second time in three phrases that you have union mentioned. United States, and now in order to form a more perfect union. Understand that America is a union of states, a compact of states. States, 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 union. Now, I realize that the framers and founders often use the word nation in their writings. But when they did that, what they were generally referring to was a culture. Nationality, so to speak. Like we'll talk about South Americans. Well, there's many, many countries within South America. It's kind of a culture. Latin America, kind of a culture. Hispanic culture. Well, when they use nation, that's what they meant. Today, when we say the word nation, or when we hear the word nation from certain circles like the fake news, what they mean is one monolithic country governed by Washington, D.C., primarily through the Supreme Court. They don't even think about states. I don't even think they understand why we have states. They must sometimes scratch their heads and say, why do we have these states? That seems to be redundant. And if you have a monolithic country ruled by Washington, the states are irrelevant. Why do we have them if they can only do what the federal government says they can do? So then, the framers understood that America is not a monolith, but it is a union of individual sovereign states. The next phrases are fairly straightforward. Establish justice, the whole idea of justice, not social justice. We're not talking about people's perceptions of justice. We're talking about justice by the rule of law. Ultimately, the law of nature and of nature's God. And as we will see when we talk about the Declaration, that basically comes from the teachings of John Locke. And John Locke admitted that the law of nature and nature's God is ultimately the God of the Bible. And we'll get there. So justice meant a standard of justice based upon God's law translated into the laws of men. Not social justice. Not who can yell the loudest or make the most emotional argument. No. Rule of law. Ensure domestic tranquility. The idea that the Constitution wanted to preserve unity and peace domestically. We don't want to be at war with each other. We don't want to be fighting each other. Now notice what the Marxists do. The Marxists do the exact opposite. Marxism functions on the concept, if we can stir up enough strife, people will so fight and hate one another that we can break this thing up. And that is exactly what Black Lives Matter is doing right now. Occupy Wall Street before that, and other movements before that. You see, ultimately, Marxism works with disunity. Well, our Constitution says we want to ensure domestic tranquility, peace among ourselves. We don't want to fight and faction off into classes and races, so to speak, even though there's only one race, the human race. The next phrase, provide for the common defense. Remember, the primary purpose of government, according to the Declaration of Independence, is to defend our unalienable rights that we receive from God. Well, they understood that. So we want to provide for the common defense of our liberties. And then they said, we want to promote the general welfare. Now, by the way, they weren't thinking of welfare checks. When they said general welfare, they meant what is best for liberty. A general sense of welfare. They didn't mean money from the government. We call that welfare. That is a misuse of the term, at least from the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. And yet that term is used because it sounds constitutional. You see the tricks that they play on us? When they talked about to promote the general welfare, they just meant the health and vitality of the union. If I said, you know, Paul Blair and I want to promote the general welfare of Fairview Baptist Church, what we're talking about is we want Fairview to be healthy, to be at peace, to be functional, to be fruitful. That's the general welfare. What's best for Fairview? That's what that means, not welfare checks. Then the next phrase, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. They understood that we must secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our descendants. It won't just happen. Liberty has to be fought for. And as Ronald Reagan aptly said, we don't just pass liberty or freedom to the next generation. It's just not osmosis. Every generation has to fight its own fight for liberty. It's something we must earn, and it must be protected and secured. They understood this. So we want to secure the blessings of liberty. And then, of course, they said, we ordain and establish this for the United States of America. So what we have here then is an opening salvo as to what this Constitution is going to be about. Now, admittedly, and I'm going to begin to show you this next week, there are ways in which the Constitution has either been amended or modified by reading into it things that were not intended originally that have done great damage to the Constitution. And you've heard me say this before, so I don't want to be repetitive, but it's important that we get this. A lot of people will say to me at different places where I speak, Dan, don't you think if we just get back to the Constitution, everything would work out okay? And I always say, which one? And they'll kind of look at me, oh, what do you mean? You mean the state constitution or the U.S.? No, which U.S. Constitution? I say, well, there's only one. I say, no. There is one today that has been amended and twisted and perverted over the many years that we've had it. Or there's the original one that only had the first 10 amendments that protected our rights and had not been twisted or contorted yet. So we talk about original intent. What did the original Constitution say and what were the intentions? Now, it's very important that we remember that words have meanings. And to know what the framers meant, we have to go back to their time. We'll talk about that next week. Jefferson made this point. He said, you have to go back to the time in which the Constitution was written and ratified to understand the meaning of the words. Over the years, over the centuries, we have changed the meaning of words. Sometimes it's just kind of a natural occurrence. Other times it's nefarious. We change the meanings to promote something that's untrue. It's not congruent with the original. So it's very important that we understand what the words meant then. Well, if you do that, then you understand their original intent. So I always tell people, do you want the Constitution as originally written, or are you talking about the Constitution that's been amended now 27 times and has been twisted and stuff's been read into it that shouldn't be there? I would argue that many of the amendments have damaged the Constitution and created a great threat to our liberties, plus the reading into of certain ideas with the misuse of phrases that we'll talk about next time around. So then it's very important that we get to the original intent. This preamble kind of gives us what these men were trying to say. If we get that, we're in great shape. Unfortunately, we're far from that today. And so what we have is a Constitution that has become dysfunctional. In fact, the Constitution that we follow today doesn't seem to protect our liberties, does it? Doesn't seem to create domestic tranquility. It doesn't seem to provide for the common defense. Why is that? Let's go back to what John Adams said. In 1813, he said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." I think Adams meant to predict this, although there's no way he could have known. But I think what he's trying to tell us is that if America ever ceases to be moral, and he was talking there about Christian morality, if America ever ceases to be moral because religion, Christianity, has failed us, our Constitution won't work. Just won't. It's written for a moral and religious people. So much for the concept of a godless constitution. But what's even more, as America has drifted from its Christian roots, the Constitution has become less and less viable. And unfortunately today, the Constitution is just a piece of paper that we twist around and make it say almost whatever we want it to. We can read into it things like the right to murder your preborn child. Do you think the framers could have even envisioned such wickedness? No. We can look into this Constitution and a Chief Justice like Justice John Roberts can say, well, the government has the right under its power to tax to force you to buy health insurance. You think that's what the framers meant? We'll get into that with the enumerated powers next week. But you think that's what the federal government was intended to do in the minds of the framers? Of course not. Or you can say, well, we have the power to define marriage as anything we want it to be, and that will include men marrying men, women marrying women, transgenderism, you name it. Do you think that's what the framers really meant? Even though the Constitution doesn't even deal with marriage, that's a state issue and a church issue. Really, the state shouldn't even be in it. It's a commitment, a covenant between a man and a woman and before God. My point is, as we've drifted from morality because Christianity has become less and less effective and the church is dead, our Constitution is dysfunctional. And that's not to even discuss the ways in which we've amended it and caused it not to work properly. We'll get into that next week. And that's still not even talking about all of the doctrines, like the incorporation doctrine, the necessary and proper clause, that have been misconstrued to teach things that the Constitution never even implied to teach or to permit or to enact into law. So, we're in a mess. I say if we don't get back to the Declaration, all is lost. Can we fix the Constitution? I don't know. The process of amending the Constitution is very difficult. It takes 3/4 of the states to ratify, and I don't know that it can be done. A lot of people talk about an Article 5 convention. We'll mention that some next week. That takes 2/3 of the states to even call for one. And then with our climate, you think we could pull off a useful one? I'm not sure. But it's important that we get these principles, this preamble. Now, what we'll do next week is we'll move right into the articles. Articles 1 through Article 9. And then we will, Article 1 through Article 8, I'm sorry. We'll talk through all of the articles. Article 7, get it here in just a minute. Article 1 through Article 7. And then we'll look at some of the weaknesses in every one of the articles. Some of them are pretty straightforward, not too much there. But some of them, wow, have been misused and are being misused today. So, that's where we'll go next week. I know we're stopping kind of in mid-flow, so hang with me. Hang on to those outlines. We'll pick up right there next week, and we'll begin talking about the seven articles in the Constitution, and then we'll break some of those articles down. So thank you so much for being here this morning. God bless you. See you next week. We'll take a look at part 2. You're dismissed.